Now, after Tuesday night's State of the Union address, President Biden stopped in Wisconsin yesterday. He talked to a crowd of Democratic Party officials, donors, and dozens of union members at a worker training center in DeForest. The president's message was focused on the economy, workers, and the middle class.
Through the American Rescue Plan, we're funding workforce development programs, including $128 million here in Wisconsin, dollars in Wisconsin, so American workers are prepared to compete in the economy we're building. This is a blue-collar blueprint to rebuild America.
In her response to the president's State of the Union address, Arkansas Governor Sarah Huckabee Sanders painted a different picture of the American economy.
In the radical left's America, Washington taxes you and lights your hard-earned money on fire. But you get crushed with high gas prices, empty grocery shelves, and our children are taught to hate one another.
Our next guest is here to help us better understand the competing claims about the economy as well as the fiscal policies that could make a difference in our personal finances. You can join in at 800-642-1234. How does the economy look to you? What factors matter to your family's budget? What's your job situation like, your prospects right now? We've seen low unemployment numbers. Is that changing your work or the workers you try to hire? How is inflation affecting you? Are you seeing the impact? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Menzie Chin is a professor of public affairs and economics at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Menzie, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me back, Rob.
Well, I want to look at the president looking at the jobs numbers and his critics looking at inflation numbers. Let's start with jobs, some pretty big numbers and low numbers when it comes to unemployment. What is the latest you're looking at on the employment scene, Menzie?
Well, I think the latest numbers were very surprising. You know, 517,000 jobs is big, you know, by any standards, much in excess, something like three times what economists had been expecting. And that's already on top of a market that looked like it was bubbling along pretty well, very tight, with even the previous estimates of job growth were moved upwards in a big revision that occurs once a year. So on jobs, we seem to have an economy that's moving along very well, perhaps in some ways so well that some people on Wall Street and so forth are afraid that the Federal Reserve might say, well, this is a sign of an overheated economy. On the other hand, average wage increases didn't show up as being particularly fast. So to the extent that wage increases feed into inflation, we might have some hope there, and maybe we shouldn't be expecting as much inflation. That's the current state of debate, at least on jobs.
Now, if I'm a president, and that probably won't happen, but if I am the president and job numbers look good like that, I'm going to try to take credit. Can you connect the dots between White House policies and or things that Democrats in Congress and the president passed that could be contributing to our current state of affairs when it comes to jobs?
Well, the that's an excellent question. I mean, it's a tenuous link between any given policy that the White House can implement on its own and what happens to the macro economy. And then there are always these lags that confuse people's ability to detect the linkages. I would say, however, you know, in the past 2 years, the president and the Congress have passed this set of bills, the bipartisan infrastructure bill, the Inflation Reduction Act. Those things, particularly the bipartisan infrastructure bill, I mean, they're pumping money into the economy of a sort that's probably less inflationary, more measured over time than some of the other measures that have passed. And so the, you know, some of that spending certainly hasn't started, but the mere anticipation that some of those funds are coming along probably helps support optimism. And to the extent that you've got a pretty stable fiscal policy so far, that is, the president and the Congress aren't fighting interminably to, you know, over which way to raise taxes, lower taxes, or over a debt ceiling so far, that stability has added to, I think, people's willingness, firms' willingness to hire and invest.
Yesterday, the president, speaking at that training center for the Laborers International Union in North America in DeForest, made a point of highlighting organized labor in particular.
For the first time in a long time, we're building an economy from the bottom up and the middle out. The bottom up and the middle out. With products made in America, with union labor, not labor, union labor.
Okay, so the president yesterday pointing toward, I think, manufacturing to an extent and manufacturing job increases that would benefit organized labor in particular. Are you seeing that happening?
Well, I think it's clear that the president has implemented a set of policies that are in some ways trying to support manufacturing. Certainly the bipartisan infrastructure bill is putting funds into activities, construction, and so forth that are blue collar. The infrastructure, Inflation Reduction Act has all these tax credits and rebates and so forth that will probably give incentives to greater investment, which will employ workers. Hopefully a whole bunch of them will be middle class and, you know, unionized. Other policies include the continuation of some tariffs, the tariffs that were placed on Chinese goods, for instance, and on aluminum and steel. There's a debate whether that is actually supportive on net of all union jobs. It certainly probably helps narrowly defined steel and aluminum worker jobs, which are unionized, but might have a negative impact on the rest of the economy in terms of employment. So certainly you've got that. You've got the sort of verbal support for unions. I think the gains in terms of union leverage, in terms of workers' leverage, has been largely due to the fact that we've got this very tight labor market. I don't want to minimize the effect of the president's support, but if I were to try to detect how the bargaining has shifted between labor and companies, I think a lot of it has exactly to do with the fact that there's a tight labor market and supply is less than it used to be, and demand is high.
Talking to UW-Madison economist Menzie Chin about the latest on the U.S. jobs picture, inflation, and more, and political claims. For credit or blame, you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a question about the state of the U.S. economy, the Wisconsin economy? What would you want the government to focus on, if anything, that you think would boost the economy? What do you need? What would help you? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. In response to the president's visit, we heard the chairman of the Wisconsin Republican Party, Brian Schimming, put out a statement yesterday. Here's an excerpt. Quote, Wisconsin households and businesses have faced crushing inflation, decreasing real wages, and increasing energy bills for months. And trying to buy votes with his inflationary spending and Green New Deal agenda isn't the answer to helping Wisconsin families. Menzie, let's turn to the inflation side of things now. We saw inflation, I think, peak over the last year or so, highest level since, the early 1980s or so. What is the latest on our measures of inflation now?
What's true is year on year, inflation was 6.4% over, 2022. But that's kind of looking backwards. Over a much shorter time span, let's say 3 months, what you can see is inflation is decelerating quite rapidly. And as a consequence, what we have is the forecasts are something like 3% inflation for 2023. So I think what we can say is for sure inflation is, for the moment, decelerating.
Now, if I'm the party not in the White House and I see high inflation, I'm, of course, going to want to try to connect the dots, saying that guy's policies are what's causing a lot of this inflation. Are there things you see, again, from the White House and from bills passed by Democrats in Congress over the last couple of years that may have, at least in part, contributed to the higher inflation levels?
Definitely some of the responses in the past have added to or contributed to the inflation we're seeing now. I mean, it's important to recall the context. We closed down the economy in 2020 for several months, 2 months to be, short enough in the statistics. And that, what did that do? That reduced demand, but it also reallocated demand to goods. We reopened the economy, but people were still wary of going out and being in public and going to restaurants and so forth. So what did that do in turn? That meant that we had disproportionate spending on goods and a limited supply and capacity to bring in goods from the rest of the world. So, I mean, the confluence of those two things, it means that you had this burst of inflation. We sort of like hit the wall in terms of what we could supply in goods. And that was that demand was in part supported by funds in both the packages passed under the Trump administration and then the act passed under the Biden administration in the first few months. So surely those things added something to the demand, so the pressure. But don't forget, we had all this congestion in the ports. And infrastructure log jams. We had the shortage of semiconductor chips, and we had the resurgence of oil prices, which then were redoubled when the invasion of Ukraine was expanded. So between the two, what we have is a set of both supply and demand factors, only part of which is directly attributable to the activities of or the proposals of the administration.
Bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Pat is with us in Green Bay. Hi, Pat.
Good afternoon, and thank you for taking my call.
What did you want to bring up?
I guess, well, it's actually twofold. Number one, when are the politicians going to stop their silly bickering back and forth? It's this group's fault, it's that group's fault. When are they going to start doing what they're supposed to be doing and working for us? And then the other thing, please, these people that sit there and they chirp about the high price of fuel and everything else, but when you look at the corporate earnings, they're in the billions of dollars.
Pat, thanks for the call. Let's go to that second point. Benzie, I don't know if you're going to solve the partisan divide here for the first part, but corporate profits, Pat, and others are saying, well, wait a minute, we're paying a lot of inflation, but we're seeing from oil companies, I think in particular, some big numbers when it comes to their annual revenue and profits.
Well, absolutely. Each time there's a surge in oil prices, then you see temporarily, at least, that the oil companies make sort of essentially windfall profits. Their profits jump up a lot, essentially because, you know, they've already invested and sunk expenditures in. Suddenly they find great demand for their product, and the demand is inelastic. That is, it's not very responsive to prices. And so in order to have, you know, the supply being matched up with the quantity demanded, the price adjusts a lot, and boom, you get lots of big profits for the oil companies. Now, if I'm talking about inflation, inflation is not just high prices. It's the continuation of prices rising over time. And so there, you know, part of that is just, you know, supply and demand having an impact. So, you know, as long as even if we didn't have the oil companies, you know, raising prices tremendously, they would still be raising prices as there was scarcity. And so the concern is that, you know, there's these underlying forces that are pushing up prices and hence inflation.
Pat, thanks for that call. Menzie Chin is with us, professor of public affairs and economics at UW-Madison, with us to look at the claims politicians make about the economy and help us follow the economic indicators that matter. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. How is the economy treating you these days? Have you seen a public policy that you think helped or hurt you in some way at in your line of work, in your daily shopping? Call in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts, your experiences, your solutions, or your questions. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk now with Menzie Chin, professor of public affairs and economics at UW-Madison, looking at the president's visit to Wisconsin yesterday, the various claims that political leaders are making about the state of our economy. Still time for your call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Back to your calls now. Tom is with us in Oshkosh. Hi, Tom.
Hi. My question is, with the low unemployment rate, how does that correlate to the very unreported labor participation rate, and how does the labor participation rate today compare to 5 years ago and maybe 15 or 20 years ago?
Tom, thanks for the call. Great question, Menzie. The labor participation or workforce participation rate, a measure that Tom says we don't often see in the headlines.
Well, that's an excellent point. I mean, you have to understand that the unemployment rate is a function of, you know, you're looking at how many people categorize themselves in it to the extent that the statisticians are happy with as being unemployed, as divided by the labor force, where the labor force is, you know, the people who are employed plus defined as actively searching for a job. And that has certain requirements of you having applied for several number of jobs. So that calculation of the labor force might not necessarily take into account discouraged workers or the workers who have dropped out of the labor force for, let's say, health reasons. And I think that is one of the factors that people have been looking at over the past year or so in tracking the evolution of the labor market. So yes, the unemployment rate is quite low, but we're probably missing out on some other aspects. And the caller's right, the labor force participation rate is down. And I think some of it has been attributed to, among other things, more people have retired than you would have expected ordinarily in the past year and a half or so. And then there's some evidence that illness, and here we might say the longstanding illnesses that are associated with COVID, have taken a lot of people out of the labor force. So the labor market is tight, partly because of the, you know, the enhanced demand that we have from some of the stimulus packages, the recovery packages of the past. But some of it is also the fact that, you know, some people have decided to exit the labor market because they're you know, they're either ill or they just said, it's not worth it. I'm close enough to retirement, too hard to find a new job in this new reconfigured economy.
Tom, thanks for that call. Rich joins us now in Delavan. Rich, hi.
Hey, good afternoon. Thank you very much for taking my call, and I really love what you're doing with your show. Just a comment about government spending. You know, we have a problem getting both parties to agree on a $3 trillion relief bill for infrastructure work that this company or country desperately needs. But when we were overseas in Iraq and Afghanistan, spending billions upon trillions of dollars, that was basically a carte blanche, and nobody ever complained about that. And as a former service member who did two tours in Iraq, you know, it's kind of disgusting to see that the amount of money that was spent over there, and we can't even get politicians to agree on, you know, actually improving this country from a financial perspective.
Rich, thanks a lot for the call. I appreciate that. Menzi, it's an interesting point, distinguishing between the impact on inflation and the future economy between, you know, big investments in military spending for a war in Iraq or Afghanistan versus maybe the same amount of money going into infrastructure development in the United States. Can you talk about that a little?
Oh, yes, sure. I think that's an excellent point to be brought up. And I'll just mention, first of all, we did pass a bipartisan infrastructure bill. And that was actually to the amount of $1.2 trillion. Now, $1.2 trillion over the course of 5 years. So it's not every year that you're getting that amount. But that's a substantial package. And I think that was something that many, many, many economists of all stripes could get behind, because we know that, first, infrastructure investment has a big multiplier. For each dollar you put into infrastructure spending, you get probably a in total was something like a $1.6 increase in GDP, which so that number is like a lot bigger than, say, for spending on consumption otherwise, let's say civil servants. Now, to the fact that about defense spending versus you know, infrastructure investment, I'm 100% behind that. I mean, you know, if you're spending on tanks and you're spending on building fortresses or camps in overseas, that's not going to directly enhance your GDP or your productive capacity in the future. It shows up in GDP, but it won't show up in, you know, how many widgets you can build next year. Whereas if I'm investing in infrastructure, you're going to be able to move things around more quickly. People will get cleaner water. If you're investing in broadband, more people can access the internet. And, you know, if you've ever have to fought to get a good internet connection, you can imagine what gains you could get in productivity once we are connected effectively. So I would say, yes, I mean, that's what people have been saying for a long time. We need more infrastructure investment. And that's one of the achievements of the past couple of years. And, you know, if somebody had asked me beforehand whether it would have gotten done, I would have been dubious, but it did get get done. There are other investments that are being undertaken, and it's harder to figure out what the returns will be. So we have the Inflation Reduction Act, which is like $400 to $800 billion worth of tax credits. And, you know, we're hopeful that that spurs some investment in green technologies. I'm not aware of, you know, any definitive studies of what the multiplier is for that. And we also have the CHIPS package, which is, I believe it's like $280 billion worth of investment in semiconductor chip factories. And we'll have to wait and see, you know, whether those investments pan out. They sound like good ideas, and they probably will have positive benefits for the economy, but it's harder to define how big they'll be.
Thanks a lot for that call. And Menzi, we'll leave it there. Thanks, as always, for joining us today.
My pleasure. Good to be here.
That's Menzi Chin, professor of public affairs and economics at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. He joined us this afternoon with a look at the partisan divide over economic policy and the effect those policies have on us and our economy in general. We take some big picture looks at the economy like that. I love them. Is there something on your mind when it comes to our economy, big or small? Something you've always been curious about, something that you think affects your life that you don't hear talked about much in the media? We'd love to hear from you, and maybe that'll set up a future conversation here on Central Time. You can email, you can always email, ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org. Let us know what you want to hear us talking about when it comes to Wisconsin's economy, the American economy, and beyond. ideas@WPR.org.